Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Imagine you're doing some household chores, mowing the grass, taking out the trash, and you feel it. A tightening of your chest. You struggle to catch your breath. There's a cold sweat. This could be the big one, or it could be nothing. So what do you do? If you're having a heart attack, how do you know for sure? We know every second counts, so what should you do? Well, we want to hear from our listeners about their heart attacks, signs that you needed to see a doctor about a heart issue. How did it go, and how did it save your life? Give us a call. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You can send us an email to thesource@tpr.org. Text us at that call-in number, 833-877-8255. We're now joined by Dr. Alan S. Anderson, the professor of medicine and chief of the cardiac division at UT Health San Antonio. And Dr. Anderson, welcome to The Source.
Thanks very much, David.
So do people recognize all the time that they're having a heart attack? Is it mysterious? Is it hard to really figure out what's going on? Or, you know, how do people deal with that?
Yeah, no, it's a problem. I think many people don't recognize they're having a heart attack in real time. I think many people have an imagination of what they think a heart attack feels like. We talk about the elephant standing on the chest, the severe pain in the middle of your chest with the sweating and the radiating down the arm. And those are what we call the classic symptoms of a heart attack, or what we call medically an acute myocardial infarction. But that is not the majority of symptoms that patients experience. Many times it's quite subtle.
So, I understand there's a range. You can have a heart attack and not even know it. You can have a minor heart attack, a major heart attack, and then there's the widow maker. So does that all depend upon how quickly you react to it? Or, I mean, why so many different types of heart attacks?
Right. Well, so we'll dispel some misconceptions here. I think the first misconception is there are big heart attacks and little heart attacks, but there are no minor heart attacks. The second thing is a heart attack, just so everyone understands what it really is, a heart attack is when an artery becomes blocked. An artery that supplies blood to the heart becomes blocked. And so that part of the heart muscle is no longer getting blood, nutrients, oxygen, and the heart muscle begins to die. And the heart muscle begins to die within minutes of that artery becoming blocked. The size of the heart attack can depend on where the blockage occurs. If the blockage occurs in a large artery that supplies a large territory, then the end result could be a very large heart attack. If it's a smaller blood vessel, it could be a smaller heart attack. But if any of those heart attacks leads to heart muscle damage, and those heart attacks can also lead to the development of sudden abnormal heart rhythms that cause the person to collapse, and that's what we call sudden cardiac death. And so some patients who have heart attacks can just suddenly drop dead, but that's not everyone.
So, I mean, I can imagine if I'm doing stuff around the house and suddenly I feel the tightening of the chest and I feel all those symptoms we talked about, the cold sweat, the classic signs, I'm still, you know, not going to call 911 until I'm absolutely sure that I'm having a heart attack. I mean, I don't know if it's cultural or whatever, you know, you want to be sure.
Right.
So what do you do?
Correct. Yeah, no, I think it's a very fair question. And I think, so the first thing is, are these symptoms different than what you've experienced before? So a person who's never had any symptoms, who has a sudden onset of these symptoms, That should be an alarm sign, because not everyone who has the onset of these symptoms has the artery completely closed. Sometimes what's happened is the artery is trying to close. It hasn't closed completely. And so the symptoms can come and go. But that represents a dramatic departure from what a person normally experiences. So if you suddenly start having symptoms that you haven't had before, that needs to be checked out. The other thing I would say is some people, when you talk to them, once they come in with what is an obvious heart attack, they've actually been having symptoms for several days or even perhaps several weeks. They've noticed a pattern of symptoms that come and go. Sometimes they are becoming more frequent. Sometimes they're becoming more severe. And they tend to be dismissive of them because they say, oh, it doesn't seem to be much, and it goes away, so they don't think about it. And then those symptoms get progressively worse, and when they come in, it's discovered that they've had a heart attack.
These symptoms that we're talking about also sound just like having a panic attack. How do we tell the difference between, you know, having a heart attack and having a panic attack or something like that?
Well, if you have a history of panic attacks, that might be one thing. It's unusual for a person just out of the blue to get a panic attack when they haven't had one before. I think the other thing that I try to tell patients is to really listen to your body. Part of this is that internal thought process that you have of, am I okay or am I not okay? Is this something I've experienced before, or is this something that doesn't really feel right? And many heart attack patients give the advice of listen to your body. If something doesn't seem right, go get it checked out. Make sure. Because maybe you're not having a heart attack. Maybe there's something else going on. There are other life-threatening conditions that can mimic a heart attack. Either way, getting checked out is an important thing to do.
Do I need to call 911 and get an ambulance, or do I just, you know, have someone drive me over to the hospital? What do you do?
Right. That's a very good question. And again, it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen. If a person is really having a heart attack, 911 is the best answer, because when EMS arrives, they have things that they can do to provide supportive care. So if you call 911 and tell them you think you're having a heart attack, that's one approach. If you're having these vague symptoms, they're coming and going, you just don't feel well, something doesn't seem right, then getting checked out in an urgent care facility or in an emergency room where you can see a healthcare provider, where you can get an electrocardiogram and a blood test to see if there's any ongoing damage to your heart muscle, that's a very reasonable approach. But when you check into a place like that, you need to tell them that you're having chest pain and you're concerned that you might be having a heart attack.
We're going to keep talking about signs of having a heart attack, what you should do if that happens to you, what can be done to check you out even before you have the signs of a heart attack. It is a killer. People are dying from this every day. What can we do to protect you, to protect your loved ones? Give us a call. Tell us about your heart attack. I want to hear your story. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK, and we're going to be right back.
Support for TPR comes from La Fonda on Main, honoring the authentic cuisine of interior Mexico since 1932. Open for lunch, brunch, and dinner. More information at lafondaonmain.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about heart attacks. What are the signs that you could be having one? What steps should you take if you think you are having one to increase the odds that you're going to survive, you're going to thrive afterwards? Get a question, give us a call, 833-877-8255. With us is Dr. Alan Anderson, Professor of Medicine and Chief of the Cardiology Division at UT Health San Antonio. Let's go to a caller, and we have Felix on the line. And Felix, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm Felix, and I was working a couple of jobs. I'm a single parent, and it was kind of getting late at night. I was out by Incarnate Word delivering some food, went up four flights of stairs, came back down. I felt okay. I felt a little tired. Went to get a cup of coffee at McDonald's. I felt real tired. And I thought, well, maybe I just go home and rest. So I went home, and I could barely get up the stairs when I got home. And I didn't have any pain in my chest, but I felt extremely tired. And then I think I talked to my daughter that lives with me, and I tried to sleep. I couldn't sleep. Then I started feeling the pain in my chest. And I thought, well, I Googled everything, and I thought, well, it's my thyroid. It was my high blood pressure meds. And so in the morning, I took an Uber to a local clinic where my PCP is, and they put me an EKG down, and they told me to get to the ER as soon as possible. I took another Uber to the ER, and when I got there, I vomited like about a gallon of clear fluid, and they rushed me back to the cath lab. Evidently, I had a 95% blockage in my artery, and I got cleaned up, got two stents, and I've never felt better now. I mean, they've got me on a 2-mile walking a day, some meds, I just, you know, I told a friend of mine that says a director at a hospital that try not to Google what your symptoms are. Just go with your instinct. And my instinct was like, I was not having a heart attack. That was my instinct. That was a complete denial. So I thought
Well, Felix, thank you so much. Thank you. And I'm so glad that yours is a survival story. We appreciate that. So, Dr. Alan Anderson, what do you make of that?
I think, Felix, I'm glad you're doing well. And he really highlights a very common scenario. Again, not typical symptoms, not symptoms that are immediately recognized. And what he was experiencing were the first stages of that event. And then it was easy to be somewhat dismissive until it became very obvious. And so that extreme fatigue is a common symptom. And again, there are a lot of things that cause people to feel fatigue. So how do I know that it's my heart? But it was a big change for what he typically felt. And so it can be very challenging. I think this is why people often don't come in sooner than they do.
So he mentioned that there was this burst of physical exertion, walking up floor flights of stairs. Is something like that typically a trigger for having a heart episode like that?
Not necessarily. The stressful events can trigger heart attacks. They can cause the plaque that is on the inside of the artery to rupture, and that leads to the blockage. I would say that occurs in a minority of cases. Usually there's an underlying pathology, and it's just waiting to happen. And when it happens is a little unpredictable. That's why people have this happen suddenly.
Another caller, Kirk, is on the line. Kirk, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I'll share my story. First time I got open heart surgery, I just started feeling really clammy. And for some reason, I took two aspirin, and my wife took me to the ER, and they tested for the enzymes. I hadn't had a heart attack, but I got in four bypasses. Second time, my wife got transferred, and I was started feeling chest pains, and I was popping nitro like crazy. And I didn't listen, and I waited too long almost, and I ended up having a heart attack and getting another open heart surgery with three bypasses. So, you know, if you start feeling those symptoms, don't wait. You know, do something. Call 911, because if you don't, you won't get to go through rehab to feel better. It's just so important to like say, listen to your body.
How do you feel now, Kirk?
I feel pretty good. I see my cardiologist regularly. I probably don't keep my weight down as much as I should, but I'm usually feeling pretty good.
All right. Thank you for the call. He mentioned, Dr. Anderson, popping nitroglycerin. Mm-hmm. So what is that? And Is that, I remember seeing it in the movies. I didn't know it was real.
Yeah. Nitroglycerin is comes in a pill form, comes in an intravenous form as well. And it's a medication that dilates the arteries, and it dilates the arteries going to the heart. And so for people who have chest pain due to limited blood flow to the heart, taking a nitroglycerin, putting it under the tongue, can dilate the blood vessels and help improve the blood flow to the heart and alleviate the chest pain. And so we use nitroglycerin sometimes, not as frequently as we once did, but sometimes to treat people who have what we call chronic angina or angina, which is the chest pain from not enough blood flow. The difference between angina and a heart attack is a lot. Angina will come and go with medications, can respond to nitroglycerin. Heart attacks frequently don't. And if you have angina that requires multiple doses of nitroglycerin, that's worrisome in and of itself. We call that unstable angina, and you should seek medical attention for that. We typically tell people to take no more than 3 nitroglycerin 15 minutes apart. If they're still having chest pain, they should go to the emergency room.
Is that like a prescription medicine? You can't buy that over the counter?
Correct. That's a prescription medicine.
Should people, I mean, it seems like if, why not make it over the counter? I mean, and if you,
no, it has a lot of side effects as well. It interacts with a lot of drugs, and it's only it's a temporizing thing. If there's an underlying problem, that problem needs to be diagnosed, not masked.
All right, let's go to another caller, John. And John, you're on the air. Go ahead, John.
Yes, thank you very much. I had a heart attack in '96 in Tampa, Florida. After a hard day's work in the horse business, went home, went out back, laid down, not feeling very good, and broke a sweat. As soon as I broke a sweat, I got up and went, and I know I'm not supposed to, but I drove myself to the nearest hospital. They got me in there. It turned out I had one artery 100% closed that had already developed its own collateral bypass, 199, 195, and 192. Tuesday morning, they cracked me open and gave me a CABG, four artery, and that was in 96. I'm still doing great.
Well, John, thanks for calling. I appreciate it. Glad to hear that you're still kicking. That's a lot of work that he got, Dr. Alan Anderson.
Yes. So, again, one of the things you have to remember is that heart attacks typically occur in people who have underlying coronary artery disease. And coronary artery disease is the disease that develops over many decades, right? And if you live in South Texas, then you're at high risk for having coronary disease because of our diet, because of our what we call comorbidities like hypertension and diabetes and high cholesterol levels. And so these are all the risk factors: being a certain age, being male, being a woman over the age of 55. All of these are risk factors. And so many people are walking around with coronary artery disease that they don't know about, and they don't find out about it until it becomes symptomatic by causing them chest pain, what we call angina, or a heart attack, acute myocardial infarction.
So what can we do to have early detection? Can that be figured out? A stress test on a treadmill and being hooked up to a computer?
Right. So there are a lot of things we do. First, we do what we call, for people who've never had a coronary event like a heart attack, we seek to do what we call primary prevention. So we check lipids, we assess for other diseases like diabetes and hypertension, and we aggressively treat those conditions. This is why we give drugs like statins to people with high cholesterol, because if you have elevated cholesterol and take a statin, we know that we will lower your risk of ever having a heart attack. And if you've had a heart attack and you take a statin, the statin lowers your risk of a subsequent heart attack. And so if we can prevent heart attacks, that's obviously what we'd like to do. testing like stress testing can help us identify patients with coronary artery disease. And so this is why it's important for you to see your physician, establish what your risks are, and determine whether you need additional testing to see if you're at risk or if you have coronary artery disease.
What's the connection with high blood pressure?
So high blood pressure damages the blood vessels and makes us more makes those vessels more vulnerable to inflammation and to the development of plaque. It also affects kidney function. It can even affect heart function. So it can just add to the complications of coronary artery disease.
So do people, are we expected just to learn as we go about, you know, heart attacks? You know, how are we, all I know about heart attacks, I learned from Fred Sanford on watching TV.
Right. And, you know, this is why it, we do our best to educate organizations like American Heart Association, spend a lot of effort trying to educate the population, know your cholesterol levels, what, you know, understand what are risk factors for coronary disease. What if you have a family history? I see a lot of patients when their brother has a heart attack and they suddenly say, oh, my brother had a heart attack and I'm older than he is. I think I need to get checked out. So family history is definitely a risk. People who have heart attacks or coronary disease at an early age, say before the age of 45, that's a risk factor for developing coronary disease in other family members.
So some people, they think they're having indigestion, but they're actually having a heart attack. They confuse indigestion, heartburn with a heart attack. I mean, it, so how do you...
Right. That's right. We call it the cafe coronary. It is, again, that... The discomfort of indigestion, that burning sensation in the center of the chest, is also what is one of the types of symptoms that people with angina or with a heart attack are experiencing. So GI symptoms, the vomiting that was mentioned, we see that in certain types of heart attacks. It stimulates what we call the vagal response. It's the same sort of thing that causes you to feel hot and sweaty and nauseous when you experience pain or get an IV or something like that, break a bone. Some people get very symptomatic. Heart attacks stimulate that same type of reflex, and so patients can come in vomiting or vomit during the acute episode.
So some people will say, well, let me wait this out. Maybe it's indigestion. If I just relax for a little bit, it'll go away.
So and when it comes to heart attacks, time is muscle. The longer you wait, the greater the risk of complications. And, you know, I'm a pragmatic physician. I try not to overly alarm patients. And again, this is where, well, do you have a 20-year history of indigestion? Well, that's one thing. You've never had indigestion in your life. You're 55 years old. You just stopped smoking and your doctor told you your cholesterol was high. And you get your first case of indigestion, probably prudent not to just assume that it's indigestion.
All right. We're going to keep talking about how to recognize that you're having a heart attack, steps you can take to save your life or someone else's life. Give us a call. Got a question or comment. Want to hear your story. John D., I'm going to get you on the air when we come back from this break. The number is 833-877-8255. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, and we're going to be right back.
The EarthX 2024 Environmental and Sustainability Congress of Conferences is happening in Dallas, April 22nd through the 26th, bringing together all sides with one important mission: protect our planet. For info, earthx.org.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about checking yourself for a heart attack. If you're having a heart attack, what to do. Taking a quick, decisive action could save your life, could save your partner's life. It happens to men and women all the time. What can we do to protect each other, protect ourselves? Give us a call. Tell us about your heart attack. What did you do? What was your thinking process so that you survived, so you can tell the tale? The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. John D., you're on the air.
Hey, David. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. In 1982... when my father was 58 years old, on a Sunday in July, he went to bed feeling ill, nauseous, mostly indigestion, and by Tuesday morning, he was dead. Mm. And I was the 16-year-old kid who had to find him. And so everything that you're saying here is very topical and very important to me personally. And I think that I can say from experience to everyone who's listening that the best answer is to get medical help sooner rather than later, because at some point you don't need medical help. You end up on the other side with the coroner. I think if I had known more and been able to do something different in that moment, we wouldn't have waited a day and a half for him to get through his indigestion. We would have had him out on Monday after he was still symptomatic on Monday, through Monday afternoon. So that's my story, and thanks for taking my call, Dave.
All right, John D., thank you for calling in. And Dr. Alan Anderson, do you want to react to that?
Yeah, I'm very sorry for your loss. My dad had cardiac disease as well. That's why I ended up a cardiologist, and so I really feel for you. And it's often a caregiver or a family member who also observes the person who's having symptoms. And one of the things that I encourage is that those family members, if something doesn't seem right, get them in the car. Men often are brought in by their wives. Their wife takes one look at them and says, there's no way you're going to bed. I'm taking you to the hospital. And if they had been singletons living alone, you wonder what would have happened to them. So family members are really, can be important. But there's only so much you can still do under those circumstances. But I think people need to look at it that a false alarm in this situation isn't the worst thing in the world. To find out you're not having a heart attack, but you find out that there's something else going on is important. And again, it might not be a heart attack, just really symptomatic coronary disease. Some of the callers didn't have a heart attack. They just came in, they got checked out, and lo and behold, they had critical coronary disease, even though they hadn't had a heart attack yet. So I think you have to look at it as it's a good investment. And if occasionally you're wrong about that, hallelujah.
Let's go to caller Lisa. And Lisa, you're on the air. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to share about what happened to my younger brother about 8 years ago. He was in his early 50s, living in Michigan, did a little bit of light yard work, went in the house, and had a massive cardiac arrest in his bedroom. Now, my nephew, who was a teenager at the time, and one of his friends were at the house, and they dashed up to the bedroom and did CPR. The fireman came, he arrested again, they did CPR. The ambulance came, he arrested on the ambulance, he arrested again in the ER, and then they got him to the cath lab and, you know, saved his life at that moment. So my twin sister and I are retired nurses, and she dashed from Pennsylvania, I dashed from San Antonio, and we walked in that ICU room, and he was on every single life support machine and IV fluid that you can think of. He made an absolute full recovery. The doctors say this is a miracle. It's interesting because we do have a family history of coronary artery disease, and I think my brother was ignoring it. And so now he's on antihypertensives and statins, and he's made a full recovery, thank goodness. What's interesting is I'm 5'2", 110 pounds dripping wet. I exercise every day. And I am on statins and antihypertensives, not because of my body weight or diabetes or anything. It's just because of my family history. And I got scared and went to my doctor, and she did a CAT scan of my coronary arteries and said, they're clear as a bell, clean as a whistle. But still, you know, and we heard years ago about the competitive runner Jim Fixed, who dropped dead in a marathon. You would think, well, if a marathon runner's going to die of a heart attack, what chance do we have? But he had family history. And so I'm very happy that you and the doctor here are talking about all aspects of it, you know, the symptoms and the family history and all of that. And so thank you for your show, David. I listen every day.
Well, Lisa, thank you for calling in and telling us that story. And I'm glad that your brother's doing so much better. Dr. Alan Anderson, there's a lot in that story about how her brother had the heart attack and the CPR was started and saved his life. I think I know how to do CPR, but I don't, you know. should people get better trained at that?
So CPR and rapid application of CPR is one of the most important things to help a cardiac arrest patient become a cardiac arrest survivor. The quicker you can apply CPR, and teaching about how to do CPR has evolved. It used to be rather complicated, take many hours to learn the taught way. There was rescue breathing associated with it. We now emphasize much more just chest compressions. You can go online, you can see a YouTube video. There are small mannequins that we encourage people to practice on. It's a much more straightforward process to learn how to do CPR. And in fact, if you call 911 with a family member who has gone down, the 911 operator will instruct you how to do and coach you how to do CPR over the phone. And is a very well-known in the medical community ophthalmologist who is on social media, and he survived sudden cardiac death because his wife, who knew no CPR, was coached for 45 minutes by a 911 operator, and she'd never given CPR in her entire life. And so it's easy to learn. It's not as hard as it looks. And so quick YouTube video can educate you about that.
Well, we have defibrillators around here at TPR, but I don't know what they're for and how to use them. What should we do about that?
Right. So the next step in that rescue chain, that first step is if a person goes down, is to assess them and call for help. Get 911, get someone to call 911 right away, and then establish whether or not they're breathing or whether they have a pulse and begin CPR. And the next thing is to call for the defibrillator, because after CPR, the next important step is the application of electricity to restart the heart if it's beating irregularly. And these defibrillators are completely automated, really simple to use. You pop open the package, the diagram will show you where to stick the pads on the chest. You punch a button and the machine will read the rhythm and it'll tell you whether you should give a shock or not. And if it says give a shock, you press the button. So they're really quite automated.
Let's go to another caller, Randall. And Randall, thanks for calling in. You're on the air.
Hi, this goes back to something you were talking about, you know, 4 or 5 minutes ago, but 10 years ago on a Saturday morning, I woke up with a burning sensation in my chest. I told my wife at the time, she drove me to the hospital, I spent the night, we did all the tests, and I was diagnosed with gastroesophageal reflux disease, GERD. I mean, it was an acute episode of heartburn. The problem was, I had no history of heartburn, and I still don't. My wife at the time, my in-laws, we'd go out to a Mexican restaurant for dinner and pull in the driveway back home, and they're tackling each other trying to get into the house just to get to the bottle of Tums or Rolaids or whatever, and I'm hanging back. I'm like, hey, what's the deal? What's this about, you know? So I wanted to throw that out there that, you know, and maybe, you know, Dr. Allen, you can address this. You know, I mean, you have your symptoms, but then sometimes there are maybe false flags as well. That's a funky term,
sure.
But, you know.
All right, Randall,
well,
thanks for the call.
It's difficult on both sides of the equation. You know, you can think you're having a serious problem and not, or you can think you're not having a problem and having a very serious problem. And again, from my perspective as a cardiologist, I'm much happier that a person like you comes in and finds out they've got GERD than sits at home and finds out they had a massive MI. So I think that's success. I think you have to look at that as success.
So how long can chest pain last before, you know, you're having a real big heart attack?
Well, that's the answer to that is variable and imprecise, because people can have what we call unstable angina, meaning the artery is not completely closed. The artery is narrowed down because of a blood clot, but a little bit of blood flow is getting through. So the heart muscle is under stress. It's not getting sufficient oxygen, but it's getting some. So the heart muscle is either not dying or dying slowly, but then that artery closes off and doesn't open back up, and then the heart muscle begins to die quickly. So that unstable angina period can occur for hours. It can occur even for a few days in some people. But if patients acted at the time of the development of that first chest pain, we would get to their problem even earlier, and we would avoid them ever having a heart attack. And this is why when patients come into the emergency room with chest pain, we have a very strict protocol that we follow. If you show up with chest pain, we're going to get electrocardiograms. If we don't see a sign of an acute heart attack, which you can see on the EKG, we're still going to keep you around. We're going to draw some blood tests,
right?
Because we have some tests that are very, very sensitive to pick up damage to the heart muscle.
Yeah, I want to hear more about those tests. You can check out. But first, we've got to take this break. The number is 833-877-8255. The source continues right after this. And the source continues. We're speaking with Dr. Alan Anderson, Professor of Medicine and Chief of Cardiology Division at UT Health San Antonio. Let's just focus on women right now and how, according to my reading, that they can have symptoms that aren't exactly like what men go through. Is that right, doctor?
That's right. And I'm really glad you brought that up. I was going to make sure we talked about that. So the next thing to remember is women have heart disease as well, despite the fact that all of our callers who had their own heart attacks thus far have been men. We see this in women. Women get about a 10-year lag on men in terms of development of symptoms. They get a little bit of protection because they're women early on in life from the risk of coronary artery disease, but the risks catch up with them usually about 10 years later than men. And women don't have the same symptoms. Why? It's hard to tell, but they don't. We've already talked about the wide variety of symptoms anyone can have, but women may have no symptoms at all. They may just have that tiredness. They may have that fatigue. They may have some sweating. They may have the classic chest pain. They may have very atypical or very unusual types of chest discomfort. And so for women, it's just as important to be attentive to that. As a cardiologist, I'm much more sensitive about vague symptoms from women as a potential indicator for coronary artery disease.
Let's go to a caller. We have Jill on the line. And Jill, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. This is such an important conversation. So I really like what you just said, doctor, and that symptoms present differently. So I have serious heart condition. I'm only 50 years old. It was diagnosed last year, and I've actually been having symptoms for 10 years. And I didn't have a heart attack, but I was probably pretty close to it. And I was dismissed over and over again. My symptoms were frequently fatigue. So when you tell a doctor that you're overly fatigued, the misdiagnosis is all kinds of things that don't get you to a cardiologist. And then the chest pain also gets dismissed, even when it responds to those quick-acting medications like nitroglycerin. And I just would love for you to talk a bit about how should women continue to advocate when they're first going to maybe their primary care provider, maybe their gynecologist, maybe they are being seen in the ER, but they don't make it to the heart attack protocol. How do they continue to get the care they need? Because I don't want people suffering for 10 years like I did. And I think my condition is worse because I didn't get care in a timely fashion. Thank you.
Jill, thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate it. And I think you're helping a lot of people with your call. Dr. Alan Anderson.
I think, again, being an advocate for yourself is really important. I think, you know, even to the extent of pointing out, hey, how do you know that this is not a heart attack or a heart problem in me? Don't you know that women don't have the typical symptoms? And certainly if you have risk factors. So I think continuing to be that effective advocate, I think these days if you, many physicians are attuned to the differences that we see in how heart disease presents in women. So I would be hopeful that there would be more enlightened providers, but I appreciate your concern about that. Certainly if you have risk factors, getting those risk factors assessed, we have a variety of different screening procedures, and asking for those screening procedures can be a really effective way of advocating for yourself as well.
And now we have Skip, and Skip is on the phone, and you're on the air, Skip.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I just have a note about my personal experience with prevention. I'm 80 years old now. When I was 65, my doctor encouraged me to get a CIMT, which I believe is a sonogram test of my carotid artery. And I was told when the results came back that my arteries were 10 years older than I was. Well, I found that to be shocking. So I was prescribed statins, but I didn't want to take them without researching them. And I did some research and decided I didn't want to take them, but I wanted to try to do it through diet. So I went on a vegan diet for about 2 or 3 years, and the plaque started to recede. And since then, I've gotten a sonogram test or a CIMT or CMT every year since then. And I've just maintained basically a vegetarian diet with very little dairy. And anyway, I seem to be doing really well. And I was really glad that I just like to urge everybody to maybe look into that type of test, because you can't feel your arteries clogging. But the CIMT seemed to just lead me in the right direction.
Skip, thank you so much for calling in. Great call. And so Dr. Alan Anderson, is being a vegan, sure, getting off of meat, will that help you?
So if a vegan diet can certainly help with people who are at risk or have atherosclerosis, it can certainly be associated with the regression of that disease. That was shown by actually a cardiologist by the name of Dean Ornish 20 or more years ago, actually probably closer to 30 years at this point, where patients who would switch to that type of strict diet actually, and they had inoperable coronary disease, their stress tests would look better. So yes, going to more of a plant-based diet, avoiding animal fats, can definitely be associated with the kind of improvements that the caller just described. The flip side of that is that for many people, that type of, for many Americans, that switch is extremely hard.
Because of behavioral issues.
It can be a very challenging switch. Sort of one of the best known of those is Bill Clinton, who left office, had three-vessel coronary disease, and adopted a vegan lifestyle. And there are many advocates for that. It can be very effective and save the need for medications, et cetera.
All right, time for
a lot of people can't do it.
One last caller, Sharon. Caller Sharon, you're on the air.
Hi there. Yes, I just wanted to tell you my husband's story and then just to make two comments. My husband went in to see the doctor thinking he had some kind of a shoulder pain, you know, maybe arthritis or something. So they did an EKG. It came back abnormal. They sent him to a cardiologist who then sent him to have a heart cath. And now the time between that initial doctor visit to that heart cath was close to 5-6 weeks. Turns out that the widowmaker was 99% blocked. Another major artery was about 90% blocked. And he went into emergency surgery about 24 hours later. One of the things that I wanted to say is that the comment I want to make is that they took an artery from his forearm instead of the usual groin area, which was a game changer in his rehab, because he could then be very mobile in getting back to his normal habits and whatever. And I thought that was just genius. for them to do that. The other comment I want to make is that he was on statins since his early 30s. This heart issue came last year. He was 68. So statins are great, but they're not the cure-all. So he still, you know, had relatively normal cholesterol, but it still didn't do the job. I've always had normal cholesterol. It's less than 185 levels. I'm on statins because my cholesterol has to be lower, because you can still have problems. I have coronary artery disease and high blood pressure. And I just want to let people know that statins are not the cure, but they are the help, and they need.
All right, Sharon, thank you for the call and your response to that, Dr. Allen.
Sure. So arterial revascularization using a radial artery. Surgeons also use an artery from inside the chest called the mammary artery. Those are certainly favored revascularization strategies. The arteries do last a whole lot longer. And then with respect to the discussion about statins, you're absolutely right. Statins don't guarantee that you don't develop, that you don't ultimately develop coronary disease. For a person who developed coronary artery disease in their late 60s, being on statins since their 30s, probably meant that they developed coronary disease that was symptomatic in their late 60s as opposed to their 40s. And so, I think that's what success looks like with that. But you're absolutely right. It's not the be-all and the end-all. It's a component to risk modification. It's not the sole answer.
I've seen the recommendation, if you suspect you're having a heart attack, to chew an aspirin if you're not allergic. Does that really help?
Yes, it does. One of the most impactful therapies in acute myocardial infarction is rapid administration of aspirin, because it can, for arteries that are trying to close but have not completely closed, then the aspirin can prevent that. When we take patients to the cath lab, first thing we do, they've gotten an aspirin when they come into the emergency room if they haven't already received one. We administer it as rapidly as we can because it's been shown to save lives.
Are we getting better at this? You know,
we are. The incidence of death from myocardial infarction is going down. More people are surviving heart attacks today than they did 15 or 20 years ago. And so the incidence of MI is going down. It bumped up during the COVID era because certain viral infections are associated with a greater risk of MI. But yes, overall, the risk of MI has gone down over decades. But cardiovascular disease still remains the number one killer of Americans. As hard as we're trying to be number two, we're still number one.
So people need to take care of themselves, take care of each other, listen to your body. Dr. Allen Anderson, Professor of Medicine and Chief of the Cardiology Department at the UT Health San Antonio, thank you so much for coming on board today. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much for having me. This was great. Appreciate all the calls.
Yeah, great callers today. And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.